Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 708, Going Deep with Daniel Hopsicker. This program is being recorded on April 4th of the year 2010, and once again, it is my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves Daniel Hopsicker, the author of Barry and the Boys, Welcome to Terrorland, and innumerable articles and also videos available through, on or through the madcowprod.com website, the herd shot around the world. Daniel, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
A pleasure to be with you, Dave.
You know, I was just thinking, today's April 4th. It's not only Easter Sunday, it's also the anniversary of Martin Luther King's assassination. And before we get back to Venice Airport, Dr. King, one of the operational elements used in killing Dr. King, were murderers and intelligence officers from connected to, according to a credible source, Robert Byron Watson, whose affidavit has been vetted and never been disproved, who were involved in drug trafficking through Southeast Asia and working with an element of the intelligence community. And according to the Robert Byron Watson affidavit and also the William Pepper book, Orders to Kill, that comprised a key element of the assassination conspiracy to kill Dr. King. So once again, something touching on these government-connected drug trafficking networks. Daniel, before we left off at the point, we were talking about the American Volunteer Group. We were talking about Claire Chennault and how the shady activities going on at the Venice Airport go all the way back to the early days of World War II. And we were tracing the evolution of the Flying Tigers and the American Volunteer Group on up through some of the CIA-connected controlled drug route airlines. And you dropped a couple of names right before the break, both of which I knew, one of which I'd never heard in connection with Venice. Let's start with Paul Helliwell. Tell us who Paul Helliwell was.
Well, Paul Helliwell was an OSS agent in World War II,
mm-hmm.
But an OSS agent again in the China theater of operations.
Right, with the history that we went into in Side 1. Go ahead.
And then after World War II, he was the CIA's point man in Southeast Asia with an office in Bangkok, and was a partner in what became Air America. So, and had many other things to recommend. It was obviously a lifelong, you could see, let's just pause for just a brief moment and ask ourselves a question. Are we just nuts? Okay. I mean, is this just 6 degrees of separation? You know, so-and-so knew so-and-so knew so-and-so knew so-and-so, so they're all part of one giant conspiracy. To answer that question, you have to ask yourself this. Is there really an underground empire, the way writer James Mill described, which controls the worldwide narcotics trade? And if there is, what might it look like? If there isn't an outfit like this, it would have 100 different names. It would operate under the corporate alias of 1,000 different companies, and would be mammoth, would be huge. And that's what we're teasing out here.
Danny, may I introduce a metaphor very quickly, and that is the metaphor of an iceberg, because with an iceberg, you see part of it, but the greater part generally is underwater, and that's the part that'll rip the bow, that rip the hull out of the Titanic, and 'cause part of this stuff is visible, and yet part of it is, the greater part is invisible. But we keep coming on these names that ring bells, and you can follow these tentacles out as far as you go, and it'll go through the Kennedy assassination, which I want to get to, September 11th, and so many other things. So, Paul Helliwell.
And I don't want to go too I don't want to go too fast, but I do want to mention that it's not just as if there was this tenuous connection with the Flying Tigers back during World War II, and the Flying Tigers had something to do with heroin trafficking, or not the Flying Tigers per se. I mean, these guys were probably 99.9% of them American patriots who defeated two empires, the German and the Japanese, that needed to be defeated.
Amen.
But people that associated themselves with these groups, and then continued on. Okay.
That's why I went into some of that deep history at the very beginning.
Right.
Go ahead.
I want to mention that while we're focused here on the Claire Chennault World War II connection and teasing that out a bit, that there are other things I haven't written about that bring the Venice Airport through the 70s and 80s. And one I'll mention is the company. Sally Helliwell.
Oh,
she would hate. She would hate to hear that I had made that slip. Sally Denton.
Sally Helliwell. Yeah, don't do that. Yep.
Who I met once, and a lovely lady, and she and her brilliant husband, Dr. Roger Morris, have written some amazing books. She wrote The Bluegrass Conspiracy, about a famous, nationally organized drug trafficking organization in the 70s and 80s that named itself The Company, which has, of course, traditionally been the CIA's nickname.
By the way, Daniel, let me interject very briefly.
Sure.
Listeners who I've now got all of my life's work up for download for free on my website. And in AFA program number 26, one of five different massive archive shows I did back in the 80s about the government involved, intelligence community involvement with the drug traffic, I reprised one of my shows from the early 80s about the company. And so it is very, very, it appears that the company, the drug trafficking network, and the company, the nickname for the CIA, are overlapped. And so go ahead.
Well, the company was in Venice.
Really?
Major presence in Venice.
I did not know that.
Well, I didn't know it either, dude.
Amazing. Yet another connection. Go ahead.
There was a man. Actually, they were integrally involved. A man named Frank Guzman. If you go to Google News timeline, the way I described, and type in the name Frank Guzman, G-U-Y-M-A-N, you will eventually discover, if you keep pursuing it, that Frank Guzman was active at the Venice Airport, very active at the Venice Airport, but that Frank Guzman isn't his real name. Frank Guzman was somebody named Mario, with a Spanish last name that I'm not going to attempt to pronounce, who worked for Batista.
Mm-hmm.
Came over when Castro took over and changed his name to Frank Guzman, and then became active in the drug trade and with three other men in Venice who were part of the company, until they were murdered in the early 80s in a Miami hotel room. Okay, so the company was very active. And so as I began to research the connections the Venice Airport had up to the present, I would see articles that didn't make sense, but did make sense, okay? A famous quote, well, hopefully someday it'll be famous, that was given me by Wally Hilliard's former bookkeeper, accountant, who talked to me through a screen door 6 months after 9/11, and I was just ranting on about how it didn't make sense that this guy Wally Hilliard had been involved with Huffman Aviation because they were, you know, it was a money losing venture, and Hilliard was a rich retired millionaire, and blah blah blah, and this guy just calmly looked at me and he said, well, sometimes when things don't make business sense, it's because they do make sense, just in some other way. And so you will find, as I found, that things happened in Venice from the 50s through the 90s that don't make sense because the same things recur again and again. For instance, three or four different times, okay, the Sarasota Herald Tribune reveals, shocked, that there are entities at the Venice Airport that aren't paying their taxes.
I can't believe that, Daniel.
And they're always the people that we're talking about. And they never pay their taxes. They're never required to pay their taxes. And when you read this, you realize, well, why haven't they been required to pay their taxes? It's because they've the city commission, the city and county officials in Venice, in Sarasota, have been either bribed or compromised, and when you look into it, you discover that there were several sheriffs of Sarasota County who never never necessarily went to prison for it, but were widely suspected of participating in the drug trade. Now, I believe I told you in a previous show when I discovered that this guy, Stephen Ruth,
yep,
at the Venice airport, had bragged to a sheriff's deputy who was a buddy of his from high school after he had been busted for burglary that one day soon he would be rich because he'd gone to Cuba on a CIA operation that where his job was to assassinate one of the four or five people, he told this deputy, that had participated in the Kennedy assassination. And that's where that, you know, like, who participated in the Kennedy assassination that was in jail in Cuba that this guy went down to assassinate would be something I'd love to find out. But
a brief thought in that regard, Daniel. It may have been that he was, because this would have been right about the time, I think, that Garrison's investigation was going on, which overlaps Barry Seal and the milieu you covered in that book. It may have been that one of the participants fled to Cuba so he wouldn't get off like so many, or it may have been part of a misdirection play to sort of not like put the blame on Castro and also obscure what Stephen Ruth was really doing. Go ahead.
Dave, let me tell you, I suspect that this guy was telling the truth to his buddy,
mm-hmm,
because he said, Stephen Ruth said, and one day soon I'm going to be rich.
Mm-hmm.
And one day soon he was rich because of successfully completing that operation, which took place in 1969, by the way.
Right, when Gareth, okay? Yeah.
I strongly suspect, certainly can't prove, that it wasn't as if the CIA was attempting wreak some vengeance on behalf of the American people for the assassins of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. They were trying to murder somebody that had participated in the assassination in order to keep them from talking.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
Clearly.
Who may have fled to Cuba to stay alive.
Who may have fled to Cuba. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So this guy, Stephen Ruth, and the only reason I bring him up, and we've gone into this too much because we've talked about it before, this guy, Stephen Ruth, was being protected by the sheriff, then sheriff, of Sarasota County, a guy by the name of Jim Hardcastle. And I know that because I interviewed an irate 80-year-old sheriff's deputy who had made it his job. Stephen Ruth was flying back and forth twice a week in a DC-4 Globemaster, a big damn plane, and bringing drugs back from Colombia. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And nobody busted him.
This, by the way, now we're talking about late 80s.
Years and years.
In other words, Iran-Contra time.
And this sheriff's deputy, because I mean, I've met many of these people who, you know, cops, good cops at least, have very simple senses of morality. There's right and there's wrong, okay? And drug trafficking is wrong. And when they discover that the drug traffickers are being protected by the people that they work for, that the sheriff's deputies work for, they you know, it's like a total disconnect, and they just crumble. Anyway, the sheriff's deputy made it his business to bust Stephen Ruth. Finally did bust Stephen Ruth after, like, he told me, like, 90 days worth of trailing him for 24/7. Brought him, you know, busted him, put the handcuffs on, took him to the sheriff's substation in Charlotte County, and the sheriff's deputy told me before he had figured out the filled out the paperwork, Sarasota Sheriff Jim Hardcastle was bursting into the office of the substation, ordering this sheriff's deputy to release Stephen Ruth, take his handcuffs off, and give him back his gun. Give him back his gun, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, now back to the Paul Helliwell.
You know what, Daniel, if I might, because you touched on Stephen Ruth, and we talked about last time and again this time about his mission in which he was going to off somebody alleged to have been a Kennedy assassination participant in Cuba. And then he said he was going to have a bunch of nice cars and lots of money and got just that. But you talked about it. Yeah, you mentioned, before we go into Helliwell again, tell me, because Stephen Ruth eventually got busted and run into prison, but you know, there's that expression, iron bars do not a prison make.
Stephen Ruth was convicted in several major drug trafficking investigations. Once in Austin, Texas, once in South Carolina, and the most recent time in 1992 in Florida. Stephen Ruth, for that, I guess, second or third offense, was given a 60-year prison sentence in 1992.
Right.
Okay? 2 years later, you will find numerous articles in Tampa and Sarasota newspapers talking about Stephen Ruth having hired from prison hitmen to murder the judge in his case, the prosecuting attorney in the case, and his own defense attorney, and he was convicted of that offense. So whatever he got for that would have gone on top of his 60-year sentence, which he had been given in 1992. By 1997, Stephen Ruth was out of jail.
Woo! And what happened to the prosecutor whom he was putting out a contract on?
Well, some of these people don't want to talk. I mean,
this was the attorney who basically, he was putting out a contract on her, and she got fired.
That's right. She did. She did.
Let me just, because there's so much going on here, Daniel. We've only got about 14 minutes left in this interview.
I understand. And I talked to the prosecuting attorney, this woman who had been a state's attorney in Florida, and received some confidential information from her, but she is still scared to this day.
Sure.
And wouldn't allow me to use her name. I said, well, I got to use your name because I already have it. You know, I already have the articles. I just won't write that you said anything about Stephen Ruth. And so I didn't and haven't. I contacted Stephen Ruth a little dubiously because anybody that's going to threaten the lives of state officials and do it with relative impunity would have no problem.
From prison, and he then gets out.
Yeah.
I mean, so this is a guy with what they call a get-out-of-jail-free card.
Many get-out-of-jail-free cards, apparently. Yep. Many. Okay, so back to Paul Helliwell. So that just certainly illustrates the 50 or 60-year history of covert intrigue, okay? Here's something I haven't told anybody yet, but and I'm just going to mention this once and then go back. They used the Venice Airport to launch coups. In 1947, coup plotters were busted as they about to take off with surplus World War II planes loaded with weapons and even tanks on their way to someplace in Central America. Okay, so they used the Venice Airport for things like that on up through history. So back to Paul Helliwell, okay?
Right.
Paul Helliwell comes back. He becomes a prominent Miami attorney, and something happens in the mid-70s, and that is that a IRS investigation. You know, I think probably the IRS, everybody hates the IRS, but they're probably their investigative arm is probably the only law enforcement operation that hasn't been totally corrupted, because what did Al Capone go to prison for? Okay, tax violations. All right, there was a tax investigation of Paul Helliwell's bank in the Bahamas, Castle Bank, and that operation was revealed only because an IRS investigator had the smart idea of getting a female IRS investigator to go on a date with the bank manager in the Bahamas. And she stole his briefcase, had an accomplice, Xerox, they called it then, all of the files in it, which revealed the bank's, Helliwell's bank's depositors in the Bahamas, and it became a major scandal in the mid-70s. Okay, I'm sure you know about this. The Pritzker family.
Yui.
The Pritzker family was the biggest depositor. I mean, it was the mob, the CIA, and the Pritzker family. Now, let's flash forward.
Okay.
And I will tell you two things that bring everything that we're talking about to the current day. One is that the man who currently owns what used to be called Huffman Aviation, named Gene Gorab, owns a private equity fund in Norwalk, Connecticut. And there, one of his major investors, I guess he had been the non-Arab one, is the Pritzker family.
Yeah, and the other one, I think, was out of Kuwait, right? Was it not?
It's the Sovereign Wealth Fund, the government of Kuwait, basically.
All righty, yep.
And Jay Pritzker, which just sort of brings it to the present. The other thing that brings it to the present that I'll tell you about, and actually, this is one thing that's two things, okay? This guy, Eugene Gorab, got rich working for, and maybe he still does, because you never know, a man by the name of Barry Steinlicht. Now, you will search far and wide and never find a bad word said about Barry Steinlicht.
Wasn't it Sternlicht?
Sternlicht.
Yeah, go ahead. Because if people are looking for it, Sternlicht. Go
right,
ahead,
right. And, yep. And this guy, when you eventually while Eugene Gorab worked for him, owned more casinos than any man on the planet. Casinos, okay? Hotels and casinos. And he has always been said to have the golden touch. He came out of Phoenix at the age of 26, and was several years later was worth hundreds of millions of dollars. And his history actually reminds me of the history of another man, an ambulance chasing attorney in Kansas City named Alan Glick, who moved to Las Vegas and a year later was the proud owner of a half dozen casinos. And the movie Casino touches on his story. I mean, he was nothing but a front man. So when you hear about a boy wonder, okay, you always have to ask yourself,
Yep. By the way, Alan Glick, part of the organized crime constellation that goes from Kansas City to Las right. Vegas. He also was involved with business affairs with none other than Al Davis, the maven of the Oakland Raiders. So go ahead, Daniel. Get another connection.
And then he operated out of La Jolla, which is where one of the major investors in the company that was got busted trafficking 5.5 tons of cocaine 2 years ago, operated out of guy from Texas, by the way, by the name of Doug McClain. Okay, so in Barry and the Boys, I at a certain point was no longer fascinated by you know romantic tales of drug pilots skimming over the waves of the Gulf of Mexico, bringing in drugs. We realized that you know the job of bringing in drugs at that point was really basically no more hazardous than driving a bus. And began to wonder where the damn money went. Okay, where the money went.
Right.
And I had a meeting. I had a source at the time. I can mention his name now because he's dead. In Barry and the Boys, he's called Gus. His real name is Russ Eakin.
How's the last name spelled?
Eakin.
Okay.
Russ Eakin told me, and I have absolutely no reason to doubt it, he was a close associate of Barry Seals. He was sitting in a coffee shop across the street waiting for him when Barry Seal was assassinated in 1986, Baton Rouge. And Russ Eakin, for years, ran for the NSA, the country of Bolivia.
Ooh.
And he said Bolivia was where the drug trade was won from. Don't believe anybody tells you it's Colombian or Peru or whatever.
Very quickly, Daniel, one of the things that listeners can access from the archives, again, is AFA program number 27 dealing with the so-called cocaine coup in Bolivia, assisted not only by elements of U.S. intelligence, but also the Moon Organization, and featuring Klaus Barbie, a Nazi war criminal, the Gestapo chief of Lyon, known as the Butcher of Lyon, and a whole bunch of European fascists, including people connected to the Mussolini milieu, and they became the bridegrooms or fiancés of death. Literally a coca fascist government that presided over this. So Russ Eakin was the guy who was sort of the broker for this milieu.
He moved to Central America, working for the NSA in 1970 and for the next, or actually the late 60s, and for the next 16, 18 years, barely came back because he was so good at what he did. And I said, what did you do? And the precise quote is brilliant, and it's not going to come to me at the moment, but what did you do down there? He said he corrupted the governments of Central and South America as part of Operation Condor. and this is the part that I have to paraphrase, for whose benefit, for the benefit of the people in the operation, is what he told me.
And by the way, Operation Condor, an assassination consortium involving many of these same Latin American and European fascist elements, and overlapping and working in many ways at the behest of elements of U.S. intelligence. The guy who was director of CIA when Operation Condor was at its heyday, so to speak, and when they killed Orlando Letelier in Washington, D.C., was George H.W. Bush. And this, again, Operation Condor, just go to my website and do a search. You can find a lot on it and on the internet, but there's a lot of stuff about these deep politics which will flesh out what Daniel's talking about. So Operation Condor, Russ Eakin, more familiar names in a new context. Go ahead.
So I'm investigating during burying the boys into where the money went, and discovered that Barry Seal's attorney had established a company called Trinity Energy for Barry's benefit.
Mm-hmm.
And that company was used to launder drug money, the drug money from the operation, which is actually the hardest part is not bringing the drugs in or bribing the politicians in order to bring the drugs in. It's what to do with the damn money afterwards, because money is much bulkier than cocaine, and what to do with the money. So he established a money laundering oil company called Trinity Energy, which ended up in the hands of a company in Washington, D.C. called ICF Kaiser, which was run at that time by a disgraced California congressman, Democratic congressman, unfortunately, named Tony Coelho. Well, I've just finished, and this isn't even the point of the story, but I've just finished a 25-minute segment, the last segment for the documentary, and it focuses on a close associate of Wally Hilliard's that you probably haven't heard much about, named P.J. Khan.
Nope.
We have talked about him.
Nope.
Pakistani. Came over to the U.S. in 1989 from the not the royal family of Pakistan, but his father was a former premier of Pakistan. So certainly it appears he was CIA connected, and probably BCCI connected. And has been operating illegally without going to jail ever since, P.J. Khan.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been given the name of a man who in Italy who worked for P.J. Khan while P.J. Khan was working for Wally Hilliard for many years, who actually I'm going to speak to shortly, who today works for ICF Kaiser in Washington, D.C., okay, just to show you how it all comes back.
Anyway, we are all out of time, Daniel. Perhaps we can go deep in yet another visit very soon. We have been visiting with Daniel Hopsicker, author of Burying the Boys and Welcome to Terrorland and the Mad Cow Morning News and the madcowprod.com website. And this concludes Side 2 of For the Record Program 708, Going Deep with Daniel Hopsicker, being recorded on April 4th of the year 2010. My name is Dave Emery. For Daniel Hopsicker, thanks for listening.